When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello gang, it's Alex here. Not our usually scheduled podcast day, but I'm popping in with a little something extra for you this week. Now, we did mention it on last week's podcast and I said it was going to go out on Sunday, but let's face it, this is me we're talking about and disorganisation is my middle name, so you've got it on the Monday instead. This is just something extra that we thought you might find interesting. A few weeks back, we had the lovely Kate Thompson, the author of The Little Wartime Library, come on the podcast. Lovely guest, and she'll be coming back at some point, I'm sure. We had a great time chatting to her. But she said, oh, I have a friend who has a link to the Match Girls, and I know you've done an episode on them. Would you like to chat to her? And when she said that this lady was related to one of the Match Girls, we almost bit her hand off. Now, it's taken a little while to get our dates aligned, but I had a fabulous chat this week with Sam Johnson, all about her relative who was a member of the Match Girls. So please enjoy this, and we'll be back on Wednesday with your normally scheduled podcast. Bye! Right, gang. Well, I have a real treat for you today because we are joined by somebody who is actually linked to one of our previous podcasts. We're joined today by Sam Johnson, who is the chair of the board for the Match Girls Memorial and who has a very personal link to one of the Match Girls herself. So, Sam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Lovely to be here.
So can you first of all tell us what is your particular link to the Match Girls strike?
Okay, so I am the great-granddaughter of Sarah Chapman, who was one of the prominent players in the Match Girls strike. So, I discovered this by accident several years ago.
Happy accident.
And, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and my life has been a whirlwind ever since.
That's so wonderful. And I mentioned that you're the chair of the board of the Match Girls Memorial. So what is that? Where is that? What's the... How did you get involved with that?
Okay, so the Match Girls Memorial was a charitable organisation that we set up in March 2019. This was sort of 2.5 years after I discovered Sarah, which sort of sent me and my husband diving into every possible bit of research we possibly could to find out more about the strike, because it was such an amazing story and we're so excited to be linked to it. And after doing sort of research, and we had a memorial walk and we did various little bits and pieces, but then we thought, hang on, there needs to be something more to this. These Match Girls need a statue, they need recognition, because what they did was, you know, they were at the forefront of new unionism and, you know, trade unionism as it became the new unionism was just at the beginning of the late 1800s was really getting going with the dock strike, etc. And so we thought they really need to be remembered, and especially in the East End, you know, there's lots and lots of people, communities, schools that have never even heard of them. And this is an amazing history for the whole of the UK, really, for all workers, but you know, in particular, it happened right in the heart of the East End, and we really felt that that should be celebrated.
Now, your link to Sarah Chapman, so what you said that you only found out recently. When you found out, How did you find out, for starters? Because if that was my family, I'd be devastated if I found out I hadn't come down the line and I'd been told it as a child. How did you find that out?
Yeah, so, well, it was really weird because I started doing my own family history research back in 2002. And I had two relatively young children still at the time. And I very quickly realised I didn't have time to do it. So I put it back in the box, but what I had discovered up to that point was that I had quite a lot of ancestors living in the East End, particularly in Bethnal Green, who were silk weavers, and they were all called Dearman. And that was our surname, and it's my maiden name.
And how is that spelled?
D-E-A-R-M-A-N. So we had this kind of notion that you know, maybe being silk weavers in the East End, they could have been Huguenots, so de Armen. Anyway, I didn't think too much about this for many years. And then I had lunch one Sunday in September 2016 with some cousins, and they said, oh, you know, just get it out and see if you can find that link to Huguenots. Just dig out your family
yes,
history
cousins,
research.
Yes.
Yes. So the next morning I went home and I kind of thought, well, where shall I start? I'll start with my great grandparents, because it was my great grandfather whose father and grandfather and great grandfather were all called Francis Dearman, and they were all silk weavers. So I thought, you know, that's a good place to start. So I typed into Google Charles Henry Dearman and Sarah Chapman, who was his wife. Didn't really think too much about that. And then this kind of post popped up from Ancestry, which was requesting information about Charles Henry Dearman and Sarah Chapman, who had a daughter called Sarah, who lived in Bushy. And as I read it, I thought, crikey, this is my grandparents. This is interesting. Nothing to do with Huguenots, nothing to do with Charles Henry Dearman. This was Sarah Chapman, one of the strike leaders of the Match Girl strike. And I'm like, oh my God, I just had no idea. I'd had a picture of this woman on my wall for years and years. Oh no idea. I just thought she was my dear little old great grandmother. I didn't think that, you know, that she had a story, and none of it came down through the family. Nobody knew anything about it at all. And it was only because this now friend of mine, Anna Robinson, Dr. Anna Robinson, had written her thesis about the Match Girls and had decided to focus on Sarah Chapman. And she actually produced this thesis, which is stored in the Bishopsgate Institute now. The strange thing was, where I had to do a little bit of detective work, was that Anna wrote this back in 2003, 2004, I only read it in 2016, and I was thinking, oh no, I need to find this woman.
Yeah.
So again, I mean, thank goodness for the internet. I did some more searching and I managed to find Anna. She's also a poet, and she had her own website.
Oh my goodness.
Thankfully called annarobinson.com or something like that. So I wrote to her, and I just on the off chance, you know, because there must be quite a few Anna Robinsons in the world, right? So I wrote to her and I just said, look, you know, I don't know, this is a bit of a long shot, but you're not the Anna Robinson that wrote this thesis about Sarah Chapman about 13 years ago, are you? And she came straight back and she said, yes, that's me. So we met up and had a sandwich together just near Waterloo one afternoon, and it was wonderful. And she knew more about my ancestor than I did. And it was just the beginning of just, you know, just a wonderful story, really. And
it's really fascinating. I think, you know, finding somebody like that in your family. So Sarah Chapman is, and I'm pretty sure we mentioned her name last time when we did it. I'd need to go back and listen to the whole thing to be sure. Why is it that Anna picked Sarah Chapman? So she clearly must have a very important role in the whole Match Girls scenario. That's the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
Yes,
so why
yeah.
was she picked? Tell us about Sarah Chapman.
Well, I think the reason that Anna chose her, I think she said at the time, was that she was slightly unusual in that her family were very kind of stable. So she was the fifth of seven children, I think. She still lived with her mum and dad, all of her siblings. And they were all born in and lived in around Stepney. And they seemed to, she was born in one place, and by the time she was nine, they'd moved to another place. And she lived there the whole time, right up through to the strike.
And which is unusual, because the East End is quite transient, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Its nature.
Lots and lots of the other workers were moving around, you know, all the time. I mean, even between the strike and the 1891 census, when you think you might be able to get some information, quite a few of them had moved on by then, and you couldn't really trace what had happened to them. But Sarah was different, and she had stayed. And the other thing that was interesting about Sarah was that they actually had a strike register. Where, I mean, many of them probably went off to the hop fields to get other work somewhere when they sort of walked out on strike and they needed to go and get some money from somewhere. But over 700 of them signed up to the strike fund, and they had to give their names on the strike register in order to claim their strike pay. And it gives their pay for the week before the strike in that strike register. And Sarah was by far the most well paid of all of them.
Really?
I mean, a lot of them were sort of took home maybe 4, 5, 6 shillings a week, and she had something like, I think it was like 13 shillings or something.
Gosh.
Now, there could be a few reasons for that. It could be that she was quite well established and she sort of worked her way up. We know that in 1881, she was just listed on the census as a matchmaking machinist.
Right.
And by the time she was, when they had the strike, she was called a booker. Okay. And worked in the patent office. Now, we've never really quite discovered what a booker was, but it sounds more important than a machinist, I guess.
Yeah.
And it could be that carried more pay. She'd also probably been working at the factory since she was 12 or 13 years old. And by the time of the strike, she was one of the older ones, and she was 25. So
wow.
It could be, again, that she was more established, you know, trusted. I don't know. But there could have been several factors. And the other thing is, of course, lots of them had such low pay because they had all of these unfair fines inflicted on them. So for any kind of petty reason, you know, drop a match, come to work with dirty feet, you're late, you go to the loo without asking, all of these things meant that they had their pay docked. And then, so maybe Sarah was just especially cute at that, not getting fined.
Maybe.
I don't know. So whether she was in a more privileged position or whether she was just good at avoiding fines or whether it's because she'd been there for such a long time, who knows? But she did seem to have more money than others, and she did appear to have this fairly stable background. So in a way, it kind of made her interesting because she wasn't like one of the kind of typical, you know, lots of fines, moving house a lot. So maybe it made her kind of slightly interesting from that perspective. But she was definitely involved in the strike from the get-go. And it was, you know, you kind of think it doesn't really quite hang together that she's this person who's got all of this potential privilege in her position, if you like. And yet she's willing to throw it all up in the air to go out and strike to stand up for what she believes in. And she clearly did believe it very strongly, to risk, you know, everything that she had.
And we don't have any information about why she, I mean, I suppose if she's come up from the ground, she'll have had exactly the same conditions as them all. And her conditions probably aren't much better. I guess there's reasons, but we don't have any actual evidence for her decision making behind that, do we?
There's no real evidence. I mean, just I know that my cousin, whose son was her youngest son, he was a strong trade unionist, and apparently he had sort of said something to my cousin about potentially, you know, he got it from his mum. You know, so I think she maybe was a woman of conviction, and I know that my dad had related that his mum, who was her daughter-in-law, had kind of suggested that she was quite a strong force.
You'd have to be.
So I think she was probably a force to be reckoned with. I think she knew what she believed in, and she, you know, she did stand up for that. And when they walked out on strike one day, and the next day, so I think there was, you know, there's the numbers vary depending on where you read the reports, but it's up to 1,400 people walked out of the factory the day they walked out on strike.
Huge
and one
number.
Or two, yeah, it is loads. And then 100 or 200 of them the next day marched down to Bouverie Street, which is just off Fleet Street, to sort of tell Annie Besant what they'd done. Because, you know, she'd written this article in her magazine, The Link, called White Slavery in London, which based on interviews with some of the girls at the factory, she'd kind of reported how awful the conditions were. And it was really after that, you know, there'd been a little bit of disgruntlement at the factory. Somebody was sacked. It was the last straw. They'd all just had enough. You know, they'd walked out on strike before, but they didn't have any external support before. Whereas now they looked to Annie. They thought, well, you're quite important. You might be able to help us here. So they marched down to see her. And you can imagine her looking out the window, and there's like 200 people down below. It's like, I can't talk to all of you. So she asked for a deputation of them to go into her office so she could actually speak to them. And the three that went in were two married women, Mary Knowles and Mary Cummings, and Sarah Chapman.
Wow.
So
already she's coming out at the top of the
already at that early stage. She's, you know, whether she just had a lot to say for herself, or whether because she was one of the older, more established ones, they kind of perhaps thought that she would be taken more seriously, that rather than sending in a kind of a 13-year-old or something, maybe they thought sending these more mature women in would get Annie to kind of take notice of them. So and Annie, of course, she didn't agree with strike action, really. She preferred to change by reform, but they'd already walked down the strike, it was a bit late. She agreed to kind of help them where she could. And she introduced them to some significant people. And 56 of them marched down to Parliament with Annie. Yeah. And she took 12 of them in to the lobby to meet some MPs. Wow. And that would have been, undoubtedly, that would have included the strike committee, which Sarah was on as well. There was only 8 girls on the actual committee. I mean, obviously lots of them were very active, and they did act as a communal force, but they had to have spokespeople, to have people who were going to stand up and actually speak for them. And I mean, it's one of my kind of pet things that I like to make sure that we mention their names, because so many people talk about the Match Girl strike and they say, oh yeah, that's that one that Annie Besant led. Yeah. And it's not, I mean, it's not quite, that's not quite the story. And she gets, claim. I mean, she never actually claimed herself that she led it. It just, she was the middle-class social reformer. So she's the name that all the papers knew. So that she was the name that got churned out time and time again.
And I think she, at one point, she was offered the opportunity to sort of head it up, and she turned it down, didn't she?
I think so, yeah. Yeah. So, and she definitely did help them. She introduced them to, as I said, to the MPs, and they Toynbee Hall got involved, the London Trades Council. But to me, I think that, that strike committee of girls, they were the ones that were going around doing the business, talking to people. And
the powerhouse.
Exactly. Yeah. And apart from the three I just mentioned, Alice Francis, Kate Sclater, Mary Driscoll, Jane Wakeling and Eliza Martin, they were the other five that made up that strike committee. And, really forceful young women. I think Mary Driscoll was only 14 at the time. So, they really knew what they wanted, and they weren't frightened to stand up. They'd stand up at Mile End Waste or go to Charrington's Hall, anywhere they had the opportunity to, they would stand up and speak about their plight. And, it got the notice of the papers, etc. So, it was really good. And I mean, to me, I always find it amazing that it was only 12 days later the 5th of July they walk out, and on the 16th, the London Trade Council went and spoke to the directors, because by this time, I think the directors were thinking, oh, this is getting a bit uncomfortable. Lots of public opinion going against them. And, they could see that the tide of change was not in their favour. And so they agreed to meet the committee of the Match Girls. And so these 8 would have gone to the board and met in the boardroom and basically, just stated their case. And it was unbelievable. I mean, in the great scheme of things, they weren't asking for anything huge. They wanted, please stop giving us these unfair fines, please give the girls barrows to push goods around in, not having to carry them on their heads and lose their hair. Please give us somewhere else safe to eat our lunch so that we don't have to ingest phosphorus.
It boils down to, please treat us like humans, not animals.
Absolutely,
which is not a lot to ask.
No, exactly. So they were granted all of the things that they asked for, which was fantastic. And one of the things, of course, was to form a union, because the foremen were pretty horrible, I think. It was very common for them to be harshly treated on the shop floor. If they dared do anything wrong, they could be clipped round the ear or worse. And if they did complain about anything, of course, it would never get to the directors. It wouldn't get that far. So by forming a union, they actually had a vehicle through which to kind of voice their their concerns and have, you know, have their concerns raised before it got to the stage of them walking out on strike again.
It's very, very clever.
Yeah.
So brave, because these girls, like you say, they're East End children, a lot of them. Mm. They've only known, you know, like you say, they get fined if they come with dirty feet. Some of them came without shoes. They didn't have shoes. Exactly. And all of a sudden they're being taken to board meetings, to parliament, the fish out of water completely. It must Absolutely. Have been very intimidating. And when you see things like that, you know that the power lies with the people who are already in power, because that's their environment. So they're not going to get fazed by that. So it's really, it's a massive thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But they were so, you know, fiery, these girls. I think they were really ready for, you know, for a fight, really. It's quite funny. I quite often, when I do talks, I quite often talk about some of the things that they get up to outside of the factory life. So they did like to sing music songs, and they had their feather clubs where they would put in money each week and draw lots to see who get the money to go and buy a fancy new feather for their hat.
Fantastic.
And they go strutting down the Mile End Road on a Saturday night singing music hall songs. And, Wonderful. You know, they had, but they also did apparently like to settle their differences by having a good old, you know, roll your sleeves up and have a fight. And that they weren't allowed to do it inside the factory, so they'd wait until they came out of work at the end of the day, and then they kind of all, you know, form a ring, and then they kind of have a fisticuffs to sort
That's
out.
That's an East End girl right there, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So they certainly knew, you know, just through their, you know, the hardship that they had to suffer.
Yeah.
And, you know, on top of not having very much money at home. And I mean, I think Sarah was probably one of the more fortunate ones, that, you know, she did have other siblings and parents who both worked at the time as well. So they probably did have enough money. They probably lived all on top of each other, but they did have enough money to eat. So she was probably more fortunate in that respect, I would imagine, than some of the others. And you can imagine some of them probably did really live in terrible, terrible conditions.
And also, you mentioned not having a method to complain, or not having your complaints listened to. Again, if you complain overly, you're going to lose your job, and that's your entire lifeline. So
absolutely,
it's you know, what if you've got everything to lose by doing that? So it makes the strike even more powerful and even more brave. But it's power in numbers, and like you say, 1,400 of them walking out, that's going to paralyze production. They are holding them to account. It's amazing.
They are. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you say about them, you know, having their complaints not heard, etc. But also, they could be dismissed if they started to show signs of fuzzy jaw. Osteonecrosis, which is this debilitating cancer of the jaw, white phosphorus. And of course, they didn't have to use white phosphorus. The bosses could have chosen to use red phosphorus, which was more expensive, but, you know, also more healthy. So it would have meant that their staff would have, you know, not suffered as much. But their
overheads, yeah. Ah, capitalism.
If they start to show, yeah, absolutely. And if they started to show any kind of signs of teeth falling out, or, you know, first of all, they'd be ordered to go and have all their teeth taken out. Or if worse, if they got even more ill, they'd just be given the sack. That was it. We don't need you anymore. Sorry, we've, you know, caused you this fatal illness, but now you have to go on, you know, lose your job. Yeah. So it was a lose-lose all round. So it was, you know, the time for change was definitely there in the late 1800s. And it was, I always kind of call it a potent mix with the, you know, the match girls, their kind of grit and determination to want to change their lot. Coupled with the happy coincidence that there were these social reformers around who were willing to kind of, you know, move
the
a few things.
Really.
Because
the girls don't have that recourse to, well, they don't have a voice. And if they shouted, nobody was going to listen. But someone like Annie Besant, who was in the right social strata and mixing with the right people, had the voice. So she could be the mouthpiece and they could be the powerhouse. And that is a winning combination right there.
Yes, absolutely.
Goodness me.
And then they formed the union, which was, you know, a wonderful, wonderful thing for them to have, because it did mean that they could make their voices heard, even, you know, within their own factory.
And was that just a union only for the Match Girls?
So when they first formed the union, it was called the Union of Women Matchmakers. But at the factory, although we always called them the Match Girls, it was a predominantly young female workforce. That's why it's the Match Girls. But there were men and boys that worked there. And so I think very quickly they dropped the women and it was just the Union of Matchmakers. But they actually had their inaugural meeting of the union only 10 days after the strike was won.
Yeah.
And Sarah Chapman was made the president, which was kind of, to me, indicates how, you know, the position that the others thought of her, you know, that they saw her as somebody that would stand up for them and say the right things. And she actually went with Annie Besant to the International TUC in London later that year. And it was striking to me that, excuse the pun, striking. She went to the International TUC. There was only about 70 or so delegates. So it was a very small affair. Only 5 women. And two of those women were Annie Besant and Sarah Chapman.
Wow.
So that kind of tells a story of its own, really.
Isn't it just?
And then 2 years later, in 1890, Sarah, again, she went up to Liverpool, which could be the only time she ever left London. She went up to Liverpool for a week to the Trades Union Congress that year, and which incidentally, it's there again this year. So I'm thinking I might go up there this year just to see. I went to the same place as Sarah. So she must have felt like completely, well, I mean, what an experience to go from, you know, working in a factory in the East End to going up and, you know, rubbing shoulders with. By that time, there were 500 delegates and still only 10 women.
Goodness
so,
me.
You know, even though the TUC had been going since 1868, so it was, you know, it's kind of 30 years in and still, well, no. Well, my maths is wrong there. Hang on. 22 years in.
You're still better at maths than me, so I wouldn't worry.
I've got a maths degree. I didn't know this. 22 years later, it's incredible that still only 10 women out of 500 were, you know, 10 of them were women. It's just incredible to me.
It shows how underrepresented the women were. And we do later see things like the Dagenham workers, the women at the Dagenham plant.
Absolutely.
And they didn't have any representation. So clearly, you know, unions, fine for the men and fine, okay, we'll let the odd women in if they get a little bit too vocal. But most women in the workplace, it seems, were not being represented particularly.
No, absolutely not. No. And I think the story I really love about the 1890 TUC is that there was a motion put forward related to the Truck Act. Now, the Truck Act was the act that related to the fact that workers had to buy their own materials. So workers in factories and home workers in particular had to buy all of their own materials and then make the product and then they'd get paid for it. So you can imagine this is not a very good system. Right. And this must have been quite close to Sarah's heart, I think, because she actually felt brave enough to stand up and second that motion. So, you know, and her name's there in black and white, you know, having seconded that motion. That's so wonderful. I think that again must, you know, is a reflection of how strongly she must have felt in standing up for her own people, I think.
And was that the same with the Match Girls then? Did they, I know they had to buy their own brushes, didn't they? Did they have to buy all of the other, the you know, all the wood and everything else, or?
So they didn't buy the wood. There were certainly things that they did have to buy, and particularly the home workers that made the matchboxes, and that they had to buy also like glue, string, all sorts of things, and it was a terribly unfair practice, not just in the match industry, it was, you know, it was generally in factories, it was a general kind of way, I guess, that the, you know, to reduce the overheads of the poor old rich fat bosses. So
Was it ever thus? And so when did the I assume the union's not still going, or did it morph into something else? Or
no, so it we understand that it morphed into, so not long after the match strike, there was obviously the dock strike the year after, and the gas workers went out on strike as well. And the gas makers and boiler makers union, GMB, was formed. And we believe that the matchmakers kind of morphed into that. Yeah. Into that. So whenever we speak to the GMB now, they kind of claim it as theirs. I've never actually found any written evidence that right. that happened, but it's certainly true that the after 1890, we can't find any evidence of matchmakers unions attending any of the TUCs.
Right.
So I'm not saying it didn't kind of stop straight away, but I don't think it lasted that long as that matchmakers union on its own. I think it did morph into a bigger, stronger part of another, you know, bigger, stronger union. And maybe Sarah was the one that was willing to stand up and go and represent them, because she actually, maybe it is no coincidence, she actually left the factory in 1891 because she got married.
Right.
At the end of the year, her dad died. Her mum and her had to move house, and later that year, she actually married Charles Henry Dearman, who was born just off of Brick Lane in Bacon Street, and he was a cabinet maker.
I know Bacon Street well.
Yeah. Gosh. So she moved over to Bethnal Green, and as far as I can tell, she'd stayed the rest of her life in Bethnal Green. Then.
Fabulous. Good for her. And it seems you know, she went on to have a very happy life with him, and, you know.
Yeah, well, they had six children, so there were certainly happy times, I guess.
Definitely, yeah. At least six of them.
Yeah. But she obviously on the more serious side, they lived through, you know, she lived through two world wars, and she would have been in the East End at the time of the Blitz, because she didn't die until she was 83 years old.
Goodness
at the end
me.
Of 1945.
Wow.
Born in 1862. So at that time, I think that was pretty good age.
Yeah.
But her husband died in 1922, because I think he wasn't a well man, but I think he liked a drop of the sauce as well, maybe a bit too much. So, and I think, I mean, they had six children. One of them died when he was only 10 days old. One of them died just around her 21st birthday. She had leukemia.
Right.
And another one died as a result of injuries from the First and Second World Wars. Mm. So three of them died before Sarah and her husband. So,
goodness.
You know, she did have a good long life. And I think she was a strong kind of feisty woman by all accounts. But
not without tragedy.
You know, it did have some sad moments. I always wonder whether, you know, given her kind of strong stance in the Match Girl strike, whether she was, you know, involved in any way in the suffragette movement? Did she kind of get caught up with, you know,
I would love to think that
Sylvia Pankhurst. I mean, it would be great, wouldn't it? But of course, there's, you know, there's nothing. I don't really have, the only tangible thing I have is a wooden box that her husband made, and he passed it down to my granddad, who passed it to my dad, who's now given it to me. And I think, Sarah Chapman might have touched this box. Well, she probably would have done, her husband made it. So, but that's the only thing that I have. There's, you know, that we don't have any letters, we don't have anything. So
I mean, if she was involved in the suffrage movement, there's a chance she might have been arrested, so maybe there's an arrest record for her, who knows. I mean, goodness, it's
my suspicion is woman. My suspicion is that probably she didn't get involved too much because she had a lot of children at that time. So I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that she at least went down and got involved in some rallies. But I don't know. It's
incredible.
Yeah, it's nice to think.
What
that
an amazing woman, and how fabulous for you to be connected to her in such a personal way.
Yeah, absolutely. After years of looking through census records and finding another farm labourer, and then to find that I'm related to a wonderful match girl. Yeah, it's
absolutely
fantastic.
Wonderful.
And at the very top, we mentioned that you're part of the Match Girls Memorial. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, our first idea was for a statue, but we've had all sorts of ideas ever since. And we're continuing to work on that. So we decided to set up this organisation back in March 2019, as I said. And yeah, we've got some wonderful people on it. So we've got patrons that represent the union, some of the unions, so the GMB and Unite, and we have Anita Dobson, who's some of our listeners may recall was in EastEnders, and she's actually an EastEnder herself. She was born not very far from the Match Factory and was brought up in that area, so we're very pleased to have her. But then we have about 8 trustees of across all sorts of things, people who are in the arts, people who are activists, people who are in unions, people who are just like me, just descendants and very interested in the story. And then on top of that, we have a layer of people who are ambassadors. So we have an ambassador from the TUC. We have an ambassador in the local council at Tower Hamlets. We have an ambassador who's, very involved in unions over his life, and just all, a whole spread of people that cover the whole spectrum of interest that we might cover. And so we have this wonderful team of people, and we're all just aiming towards getting these memorials underway, some of which we already have. So we helped, it wasn't our application, but the people who live in the old factory at Bow Quarter in Fairfield Road, that's now a kind of gated community with residents living there. And the people who lived there thought that they ought to have an actual Match Girls plaque, because years ago, a plaque was put up to Annie Besant. Mm-hmm. And while Annie Besant was very helpful to the Match Girls, lots of people think about her as the leader, but she wasn't the leader. She helps them, yes, for sure. Mm. But that they had their own, their own kind of force of nature to make things happen. And so it was felt that they should have their own blue plaque. Absolutely. So an English Heritage blue plaque was put up in July last year at the factory, and we were there at the unveiling, and we supported that application in as many ways as we possibly could. We were, throwing information left, right and centre at the English Heritage to try and encourage them to say yes. And yeah, we had a great day there with lots of important people, and we had speeches, and it was a very lovely day. And this year we're also doing something to celebrate, because obviously July is the month that they went out on strike, and this year is the 135th anniversary of the strike. And so a couple of things are happening. On the 1st of July, we have an information panel that we've worked with the Tower Hamlets Council, and that will be unveiled at Grove Hall Park on the 1st of July. So we're really pleased about that, because that's literally at the other end of Fairfield Road, so it's right near the factory, and that will tell local people the story of the Match Girls.
Wonderful.
And then we will also, that same evening, at the Queen Mary, the Great Hall of the People's Palace at Queen Mary University, we are actually having the premiere of a new piece of music that, in partnership with East London Music Group, we've commissioned a composer to write a new piece of music about the Match Girls.
Wow.
And this is just, it's amazing, thing to have. It's such a lovely kind of living memorial, if you like. So we're very much trying to sell tickets for that, because it's a great event.
And what date was that, did you say?
It's the 1st of July. It's 7 o'clock. And it's, the tickets are on sale through Eventbrite. So
interesting. I'm sensing a podcast evening out here. Okay, leave that with me. We'll see if we can. We've done this before where we've got our listeners together to come and all go to something together. So I think this is sounding brilliant.
Yeah,
so,
I mean that
we can people can just come to all of these events. They can just turn
absolutely
up and book tickets.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean the unveiling of the panel in Grove Hall Park is, we're limited on numbers there because otherwise we have to get all sorts of permissions from the council, etc. So that's really just going to be focused on local residents and them celebrating their own little park. And the, you know, the history connected to it. But the evening event at Queen Mary is open to all. You know, I think we've got capacity for over 700 tickets.
Wow. Okay.
So there's lots of space. And I think it's really exciting because it includes lots of local choirs. And so we've got the East London Community Band. Mm-hmm. We've got the Poplar Singers. We've got Aldersbrook Choir. We've got, I'm not going to be able to remember them all now. This is
don't worry, we can look them up. It's fine.
They've actually formed a new children's choir, and so it's really nice that all of these different choirs are coming together to be about 200 in the choir and band on the stage alone.
Oh my
so
goodness.
I think it promises to be quite a lovely event.
This
so,
is fantastic. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, so that's our really exciting kind of 135th anniversary piece, I guess.
And where can people find out information about this? I assume you have a website that where all of this is listed?
Yes, yeah, we have a website. It's very easy to remember, just www.matchgirls1888.org. And we're on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, all at the Match Girls, I think it is. Okay. So yeah, very easy to find. And all of the links to the tickets, etc., would be on our social media channels.
Wonderful. Well, we will definitely link those over so that we can try and get some people in to come and have a look.
That would be fab. Yeah, that would be fab.
Sam, thank you so much for coming and chatting to me. It's been lovely, and I think it'll be great for our listeners to just have that lovely personal touch to it. And we didn't really. I feel like we must have mentioned Sarah Chapman, but we certainly didn't. Pull on that thread the way that you have. So it's wonderful to kind of revisit one of our favourite episodes and find another angle on it. So thank you so,
great.
So much.
No, glad to be
and so
help.
that website again is matchgirls1888.com.
.org.
Sorry, see, I knew I'd get it wrong. Yeah, standard. At least I got the numbers right. That's impressive for me. So matchgirls1888.org. For lots of information, and I think what we might do is see if we can't get a little bit of a podcast posse to come to the concert.
That'd be wonderful. Yeah, that would be wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you so much.